This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The search and rescue effort in Surfside has become a search and recovery mission nearly 2 weeks after the collapse of the Champlain Towers South condominium building. As of Thursday morning, as many as 80 people were still unaccounted for and 60 confirmed dead. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Carver said they'd exhausted every option available in the search and rescue mission. The work of searching through the rubble had sped up some after the rest of the building was demolished over the weekend. I spoke with WLRN's Veronica Zaragovia on Wednesday before officials announced they were no longer looking for survivors. Well, I'm joined by Veronica Zaragovia. She's a healthcare reporter with WLRN in Miami. Veronica, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
So you've been covering this story for nearly 2 weeks now, and it's obviously been a story which has been at the forefront of everybody's attention in Florida and across the world, in fact. Just tell me a little bit about what you've been seeing and what the latest is with the recovery and the rescue effort there.
Yeah, it's so ever since they detonated the remaining portion of the South Tower, then we've been able, for instance, they have taken members of the media to go see that portion, because what had collapsed was the side that faced the ocean, and we were taken to the side that faced the main thoroughfare, which is Collins Avenue, and it helped to see just the impact to human life, because you could still see mattresses in the rubble and a couch cushion. And we know that because of the ability of search and rescue team members to now get closer to that part of the rubble, that the efforts are moving a bit faster. And so numbers are now actually changing quite a lot from just morning to afternoon even. And we had found out that they've identified three of the most recently found victims. And two of them were, it was a former Uruguayan diplomat and her husband. And then another man who lived on the top floor, and he was actually an engineer who had a background in the very issues that are happening in this building. So that was very unfortunate to see as well. There was a question at a morning press conference Wednesday to the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Chief Alan Kaminsky whether any of the victims that have been found might have survived the initial collapse, and he immediately said no and left it at that. So it's kind of this situation that continues to be extremely difficult for everybody involved. And it's just like every day there's more grim news coming out of Surfside.
The couple victims you mentioned before, the Uruguayan and then the engineer, I mean, everybody has there's a story behind each person, right? And I think that's sort of part of the incredibly difficult task of for the first responders, for the family, and for the reporters, right? You want to do justice to the people who are lost in this tragedy.
Absolutely, and it's very difficult, to the point that even in Wednesday's morning press conference, the mayor of Miami-Dade County, Daniela Levine-Carver, who's been pretty stoic, you know, as strong as she can be in all these press conferences where day after day she's reading death toll numbers, she broke down in tears and had to step away for a short while. And I think that it's very difficult. Yesterday, there was a funeral service of a family that included two young girls. Two of them had to fit them in the same coffin. So really, this is just so difficult for everybody. It's such a small town. It's eight blocks. It spans eight blocks in length. And so many people knew each other. The condo life is such a part of this region of South Florida. And and as you said, it's just the stories. Everybody, there are people, for instance, there's a doctor whose brother had come down to visit him, and then the two of them are now either missing or deceased. And there are so many stories like that of people who had family come visit, a sudden decision to go stay in this building that night, a young couple who are missing. And so it's like all of these very unfortunate instances, just a wide range of very tragic stories.
Yeah, all these people united by tragedy. Now, this is close to where you live, so you know this community. So what's it like kind of reporting on a place where you've probably seen that condo building, walked past it before? How do you go about reporting on that, a story that's pretty close to you?
Yeah, exactly. I think I can, for instance, I just feel pretty familiar with the Jewish community because I grew up in a neighboring town about 5 minutes from Surfside, and I think that's helped me understand kind of the traditions when it comes to the Jewish community or when it comes to Spanish speakers or just speaking to anybody. I've spoken to people who work as cleaning assistants in homes, to family members, to clergy. You know, it just, if it's in Spanish or English, it just kind of helps to be part of this community in a way, or very close to it, and understand what they're going through, because it is a very pedestrian friendly area as well. And so just people, yeah, like you mentioned, just people would walk by, and certainly we've all passed by this building many times. And it's been hard to see, though. For instance, for some time the beach has been blocked off in certain parts, and so just the one area that was giving people a little bit of a respite and a place to get some fresh air was also closed off. And so it's just hard to see it, but I deeply empathize and hope that I'm helping to do justice to the stories. I'm truly, I think the reporters are working around the clock and being as careful as they can with the nature of this story.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Veronica Zaragovia. She's a healthcare reporter with WLRN. We're talking about the recovery effort in Surfside. I'm just kind of thinking about what's next as well. Like, there's a sort of a broader impact to this. There are questions obviously being asked about the tower itself, questions about other buildings of similar vintage. Do you get a sense, or do you have a sense, Veronica, about, you know, what comes next in terms of investigating whether other buildings may be unsafe as well, and kind of where we go from here?
Well, let's say, for instance, in Surfside itself, the mayor of the town, Charles Burkett, has said that his town has sent a letter to all of the high-rise buildings in the area to make sure that they can tell their residents that it's safe for them to live there. So I think there's going to be a lot more oversight in the past. I've read, thanks to the tremendous reporting of the Miami Herald, about buildings that had been so behind in submitting their 40-year assessment paperwork that I think that would no longer be permitted. And there might be legislation that will be considered in the next legislative session. And also, just we're hearing, for instance, there's a building maybe about 6, 7 miles away from all of this in a city, North Miami Beach, that people were evacuated. You know, I don't want to paint a picture like all of South Florida is evacuating and buildings are collapsing, but there's just going to be a lot more care. We're going to see the impacts of, on the real estate industry and all that's related to it, construction and tourism. And also, I think there might be a look into these condo management bodies, because these are often people who don't have backgrounds in engineering, and they're making very sensitive decisions that could impact lives. And so I don't know how buildings will change that, but I imagine that there's a lot of discussion of how these bodies are formed and what kind of authority they have.
As a healthcare reporter, I imagine you're focusing on the sort of mental health aspects of a tragedy like this, but also there's another side to the story, right? With the recent, revelation that some of the first responders came down with COVID or were diagnosed with COVID. This is a very complicated story to be reporting on, but just tell us what you know about that aspect of it.
Right. There were 6 members of the search and rescue team, one of the Florida teams that had tested positive for COVID. And so they're at the moment recovering. And now that so many team members are coming from other states, including Indiana and Ohio and Pennsylvania, the fire chief of Miami-Dade said that they're doing strict testing to make sure that people test negative before they start working. But as we know with this virus, it could be that people develop symptoms later on. So I think this discussion of vaccinations and being careful, because people are actually, a lot of them, I was told yesterday, they sleep in the area, their tents set up for them to sleep in. So they're not necessarily going home and spending time away from this. So people are in close quarters, they're working together all day. And even though they're outside during the work hours, it seems like the virus can spread as it has.
Right. And as we were talking before we started recording this, but you made the point that this is a story which has eclipsed everything else. Like the pandemic has taken a back seat while people focus on the disaster at Surfside, right? So people probably aren't thinking about COVID and how to protect themselves against that in the meantime.
That's right. And I hope that in what capacity I have as a healthcare reporter to remind people that there are still, Miami-Dade, for instance, has reached about 72% of people who have received at least one shot of your age 12 and older. But that means there's still a lot of people, both in this county and across South Florida and in our state, who have not been vaccinated. And it used to be a lot of the focus was on how do we get those people vaccinated? How do we bring vaccines to as close to their doorstep as possible? And that all of those efforts are happening, but we're not hearing about them. And as the Delta variant becomes such a concern for healthcare professionals, it's our duty as reporters to remind people to be safe and get protected.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Veronica, a story as complicated and challenging and traumatic as this, how are you doing? You managing to take care of yourself while you report on this important story?
Thank you so much for asking. Well, I always hesitate to focus on myself. I have seen how important it is to take a little time to process everything that I'm seeing. I feel like everybody who goes out there has been incredibly kind and helpful. From fellow reporters, we just kind of have an understanding that if we're interviewing someone, that of course another reporter is welcome to join in, or police officers, first responders, everybody's trying their hardest to smile despite the devastating situation. And I think that certainly helps. And people in this state are very friendly, and that's something that really helps, that while I'm approaching people to ask them about a devastating situation, that it's still that human contact that helps, maybe talk about something that helps lighten the day a little bit. And I really appreciate the question, and I'm hanging in there despite all of this. So thank you.
Well, Veronica Zaragovia, healthcare reporter with WLRN, reporting on the Surfside collapse and the aftermath. Thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for your time as well.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
As well as the human toll of the Surfside disaster, there are likely to be wider economic impacts. Condominium residents statewide are asking questions of their condo associations in the wake of the disaster, and there could be revaluation of condo buildings and potentially higher insurance costs. Well, for more on the economic implications of the disaster, we're joined by WMFE economic commentator Dr. Hank Fishkind. Hank, thanks for being here.
Pleasure, Matthew.
Well, first of all, a disaster of this magnitude has both a human toll and an economic impact as well, right? So what are some of the economic implications of this?
Well, there are many. There's going to be a revaluation of buildings of this vintage, Matthew, and there's going to have to be higher insurance costs as well. And many buildings are going to find out that there's significant repairs that have been overlooked and that they will be assessing their residents. And so all of that will have negative economic consequences on the valuation of these buildings.
I think when you think seaside properties and risk, oftentimes the thought is hurricanes and catastrophic weather events. But this is something a little more insidious, right? Like one of the thoughts or the theories about what might have caused the building in Surfside to collapse, of course, speculation a little bit at this stage. But some of the theories out there are it's sort of a process that may have been going on for some time.
Oh, there's no doubt that that's the case, and the preliminary results that have been published point to that. If this building has these problems, then any building that hasn't been scrupulously maintained over 40 years may have similar frailties.
Mm-hmm. Search and rescue efforts, too, are obviously very complex. What does a disaster declaration then do to help local officials carry it out and pay for the work as well?
Well, it certainly provides federal funds to pay for much of this very expensive work that occurs both in the disaster review and recovery, and also for the individuals that are directly affected.
Mm-hmm. And how critical is that federal help? I mean, can counties and states kind of get by without it, or do you just assume that that's a necessary part of the sort of recovery process?
Well, a county the size of Miami-Dade County certainly could pay for these things. But it would be burdensome. And one of the reasons we have federal government and FEMA is to take care of these kinds of things for all of us, and we all pay for it through our taxes.
Can you make analogies between what's happened in Surfside and the impact of disasters like Hurricane Michael a few years back? I mean, you know, some of those communities that are affected by hurricanes, for example, the long tail on a disaster like this goes for some time, right? Some years. I mean, they're still sort of rebuilding years later.
Oh, yes, absolutely, for hurricanes, and that certainly was true, of course, with Andrew. So it has a big effect over a long period of time. It'll be instructive to see what happens with the other buildings, and then we'll know the extent of whether this is revealing something that is much more widespread or whether this is really an isolated problem caused by a lack of scrupulous maintenance. Mm-hmm. I tend to think it's going to be the latter. But there are going to be some significant findings as we inspect more and more buildings to make sure this never happens again.
Hank, if you think about just kind of real estate in general, obviously there's a lot of seaside real estate. Sort of long term, will this have a significant impact on real estate? Could it put a dampening effect on people's willingness to buy near the sea?
No, not this one event, but what we will see over time is rising insurance rates and more problems with flooding, and those things will have significant impacts on the cost of living on the coast like that, and that will inhibit the development. But certainly the prices have just surged this year on these oceanfront properties in particular, so we haven't seen the decrement yet, Matthew.
Mm-hmm. Well, Hank Fishkind is the president of Fishkind Litigation Services. Dr. Fishkind, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt.
Still to come on Intersection, clinicians are learning more about the psychological burden on first responders who are on the front lines of disasters like the Surfside building collapse. We'll talk more with Professor Deborah Beidle of UCF Restores. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. For the last 2 weeks, search and rescue teams from all over the state and some from overseas have joined Miami-Dade Fire Rescue staff to comb through the rubble of the Champlain Towers South building in Surfside. The search and rescue mission has now become a search and recovery effort. The work of combing through the rubble for any trace of survivors has been physically demanding, and it's taken an emotional toll too. UCF's Deborah Beidle and a team from UCF Restores went to Surfside to talk with first responders. I spoke to her about the impact a disaster like this can have on those first responders. Deborah Beidle, thank you so much for joining us. It's nice to speak with you again.
Thank you very much for inviting me to join you today.
I want to start by just asking what the team is doing specifically in Surfside, because you know every disaster is different. I'm sure every situation that you and your team respond to is a little bit different. What stands out for you about this one?
Well, this is an interesting one in the sense that we are part of the Florida Firefighters Safety and Health Collaborative. And so we went down when they went down to provide peer support and mental health or mental wellness counseling for the people who were down on the pile. There were 8 search and rescue teams from throughout Florida who went down to assist in this. And for many of them, they had never dealt with a traumatic event of this magnitude. They were used to doing search and rescue after hurricanes or fires or things like that. But the scope of this, the fact that the entire building or half the building fell down, was something new. So we were there to just provide mental wellness support and talk to the guys if they were having difficulties during their time on the pile.
How big is the team that you sent down to Surfside?
From UCF Restores, we sent 3 people down, including myself. And the reason for that is that we knew this was not going to be a situation where we were going to be sitting down and doing hour-long counseling sessions. This was what we call psychological first aid, which is just to help people in their immediate distress, help them find resources, help them learn to manage that stress, and allow them then to go on to do what they needed to do.
I think everybody who's involved in this kind of work, they don't give up hope, right? I mean, I've seen some interviews with some of the search and rescue folks and officials, and you know, if there's a miracle to be had, they'll be there to see it through. But with each hour that passes, it must get, you know, the chances of finding a survivor become ever more implausible. So, what kind of impact does that have on a search and rescue team, you know, knowing that at some point it's going to become search and recovery rather than search and rescue?
I think it does lend a little bit of a different slant on this. Of course, as the days went on, as I was down there, we got down there, you know, almost 5 days after this, and some people were starting to really understand that the likelihood of finding someone, particularly with you know, a 13-story building collapse with a concrete roof, it's a little bit different from some other things where there might not be as much rubble to get through to find people, where people might have pockets of air. This was just so flat. So I think they understood what they were doing, but still, they're going to do it, and they're going to hold out as much hope as they can. And also inside, I think, understand that what they're really going to find are not people who are still alive, who survived this, but to give closure so that people know what happened to their loved ones is so important. And that's what they were determined to do.
UCF Restores and the work that you and your team have done over the last few years has really, I think, developed a reputation amongst first responders. I mean, we spoke on Intersection a month or two back to one of the SWAT team members that was involved in the Pulse nightclub shooting, and he talked about the work that UCF Restores has done to help first responders in the aftermath of that. I'm just wondering, sort of thinking about Surfside, was it a request from the SAR teams, or did you sort of think, okay, this is a situation where we know we're going to be helpful here? Like, how did that process work of you getting involved in the and you know helping the folks who are there on the ground?
Because there is this organization called the Florida Firefighters Safety and Health Collaborative, we are their mental health partner. So whenever there is an issue that surrounds mental health or trauma, we are the partner that they call in. So they called and said, will you be able to go? And I said, of course we'll be able to go. Do you want us to leave right now? And they said, well, wait till we get down there and we'll call you for when we need you. Because, you know, in the beginning, there's nothing that people like me can do. All the focus is on, you know, at that point, the rescue. And so as we continued, then there was more of a need for us. And so we deployed when we would be most helpful and be able to really do something. And so that's what we did. But there was no doubt in my mind that we were going down. It was just a matter of when we would be helpful and not in the way.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Professor Deborah Beidle. She is the Executive Director of UCF Restores. We're talking about the psychological trauma facing the first responders involved in the search and rescue effort in Surfside. So what are some of the things that some of the signs, I guess, that your staff are trained to see? Like, what are they looking for when they're speaking to first responders who are involved in this kind of work?
So we're looking for people who, you know, might look distressed. And for us, that means people who might have tears in their eyes, people who might not be laughing when everybody else is laughing at something funny, people who may be isolating. And basically what we did was we just made ourselves available. So where there was a big food tent and we were all getting lunch, we would just go and sit with some of the teams and just say, can we get you guys some water? You know, do you need some cookies because you don't have dessert? How are you doing? And then we just start talking. And at this stage, the goal is to just let people talk to us and we listen. And so we listen to various things that people would say, the experiences that they would have, and just sort of supported what they were doing. But the goal is to just let them tell us what they want to tell us at this time and let them know that we're there. We're there. We were there down there. We're there here now. And we're going to be available for as long as they need us.
Mm-hmm. How do you think this work is compared to some of the other traumatic events that UCF Restores has responded to? For example, working with survivors of Hurricanes Maria and Irma.
In some ways it's different, and in some ways it's going to be very much the same. I think the things that might, as we call, trigger people's anxiety response are obviously going to be a little bit different. So after hurricanes, we often find it's thunderstorms, it's lightning, it's the sound of wind. In this case, I think it's going to be different sounds of cranes working, for example, to try and get some of this stuff out of the way, signs of jackhammers as they try and get through some of this concrete. also some things that they might find. So example, clothing. We hear this a lot, particularly in pediatric calls. Firefighters will say that little guy was wearing the same outfit that my son has, you know, and now every time I see my son in that outfit, I start thinking about that horrific event and that little boy that I couldn't save that day. And so I think it's going to be some visual things like that that are going to be problematic for people in the long run. But again, I want to emphasize that we don't go in there thinking that everyone who responds to this event is going to somehow have trouble. The message that we gave was, it's okay to feel okay right now. It's okay to not feel okay right now. And it's okay if you feel right now and you don't feel okay later. Everybody responds to traumatic events differently. And that's the message that we try to get out to people.
I wonder too about how you approach a traumatic event that happens within the framework of maybe another traumatic event, or, you know, when people are already dealing with trauma, because everybody has been experiencing the pandemic, right? First responders have had a particular window into that and having to respond to some of the, you know, the frontline effects of that. And then you have an event like this to deal with on top of that. What kind of different approach do you have to take when you know that there's kind of like layers and layers of potential trauma that some of these first responders are going to be exposed to?
I think the layering that you said is actually a very good word for that, because we know that, you know, as the first responders will say, well, this was the one that kind of broke me, but it may not in many instances have been the most severe one that they've experienced. So they may have had, for example, a particularly horrific car accident where maybe they saw some people who were dead. And then this event may go on top of it. And maybe in this event, they didn't find anybody, but that just constant stress was sort of the tip that now makes them have some difficulties and maybe makes those previous events bubble to the surface. So the interesting thing about first responders, as opposed to a lot of the people in the military that we saw, is that, you know, first responders' job is trauma. That's what they do every single day, is respond to trauma. So they have a likelihood of many, many different traumatic events. And sometimes it's just finally they get to the top and there's no more room, as we talk about it, to stuff it down in that trash can anymore. The trash can is full. The trash can is overflowing. And that's what we have to think about, is do they still have the resources to be able to deal with this one additional event that's now happened?
So do you feel, Deborah Beidle, that the response or the approach to our first responders to traumatic events has changed? And is there now more of an emphasis on self-care when teams are contemplating big tasks like this?
Absolutely. And what we've put into the treatment of first responders or the assistance to first responders is this whole idea of peer support. So when we were talking to people, it wasn't just Deborah Beidle, you know, psychological health provider that was there. It was also a fireman or a firewoman, a fire person who was peer support. So we would go as a team. The idea being, when we think about first responders, they don't always want to talk to someone who's got a clinical hat on. If you think about it, these are people who are helpers. That's their whole life, is being a helper. Asking for help is really difficult. So sometimes it's easier for them to ask for someone who is a peer, or to talk to someone who's a peer who understands what it's like to be in the fire service, for example, and have that approach, that they understand it. The other thing we've done is, with our clinicians now, we are very insistent, and we're working again throughout the state, that clinicians who work with fire or emergency personnel go through what we call cultural competency training. You have to understand what firefighters are like. You have to understand how they work, and you have to understand and know and be able to work with the types of trauma that they see. Now that the fire personnel are reaching out for help, we want to make sure we have therapists who don't fire their patients, because that's happened in the past. You know, so therapists will say, I can't treat you because what you're telling me is too traumatizing for me.
Right. And is that approach, I mean, is that changing too? Do you find that clinicians now, they have more tools to to help than they may have had sort of 5-10 years ago?
Absolutely. We know that the cultural competency training is very helpful. We also have more knowledge about what therapies are really effective for working with trauma and for working with firefighters and other emergency personnel, first responders who experience trauma. We're developing a new VR system that includes scenarios about first responders. And when we did this, we had so many first responders who reached out to us and said, I got a scene you have to use. You have to put this in. So again, accepting that they knew they needed help and they were an active part in making sure that the services they received were effective and appropriate for first responders.
Finally, what are some of the things you think supervisors or people who are doing the work on the ground need to be looking out for in the weeks ahead?
I think they need to be looking out for people who might be experiencing severe distress, and I think they have to be willing, as they are, to allow people to take a break when they need it. So maybe it isn't even break time, but if somebody says, can I just go take a break, allowing that person to go and do that. The fire service is very, very aware of it, and the care that they provide for people and the emphasis on self-care and taking care of each other. That's the real message that they put out there is, maybe you don't need help, but maybe the person next to you does, and you need to be there for them. So in the long run, just knowing that as we continue to do this, that these things are going to build up is going to be most effective. The state teams rotated out. FEMA has teams in there now. And I think the next thing that will happen is, if this continues, I wouldn't be surprised if state teams and UCF Restores end up going back down there in a few weeks if we're still looking for people.
And I guess as a follow-up to that too, what would you say to civilians who are obviously experiencing this trauma too? I mean, this is an event that's had sent shockwaves through an entire community in South Florida and beyond. A lot of international folks were involved in the tragedy as well. So are some of the things you're kind of pointing to now applicable to people who aren't first responders but are going through all of the same, impacts of this trauma as those people doing the work on the ground?
Absolutely. I would say, first of all, that everyone should accept what they're feeling, give themselves some time, allow, this to come to some closure. And then if you need help, reach out. There will be grief. There will be trauma. Just reach out and get help. The message that I always try to give is trauma changes you forever. I've been changed by going down there, but you don't have to be in your house alone. You can get your life back. You'll be different, but you can continue to live and to go on and to experience life. So that's the message I want to leave people with.
Deborah Beidle is a professor of psychology at the University of Central Florida. She is also the executive director of UCF Restores. Deb, thanks so much for speaking with us and appreciate the work you're doing, and thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Matt. It was great to talk to you today.
Still to come, how to reimagine the future in a rapidly changing world. We revisit a conversation with Joe Tankersley about envisioning a future that's neither dystopian nor utopian. Stay with us. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Amid political turmoil, environmental challenges, and eroding trust in democratic institutions, the future can look pretty bleak. Joe Tankersley says it could be a lot brighter than people imagine, and he's on a mission to persuade people to change the way they think about the future. Tankersley's a futurist, and he's the author of Reimagining Our Tomorrows, Making Sure Your Future Doesn't Suck. I spoke to Tankersley back in April 2019 about what futurists do and about finding a middle ground between dystopia and utopia in the vision for the future. Joe Tankersley is the author of Reimagining Our Tomorrows, Making Sure Your Future Doesn't Suck. Joe Tankersley, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Matt.
First of all, I want to start by asking about what a futurist is. Now, you're a futurist. For the layperson, what does a futurist do?
That question gets asked all the time, of course.
Sure.
The real role of a futurist is to help organizations think more proactively about what might be coming. It's not about predicting the future. It's about understanding the trends today and what they might turn into, say, in the next 10, 15, 20 years. If you're forewarned, then you have the ability to begin thinking more progressively about what you want to do. So the future doesn't surprise you. You get to shape more of the future.
Do all big companies have a futurist or somebody who has that kind of role? Like, if you're a bigger company, you're probably there's more need for making sure things don't go off the rails down the track, whether it's 10 years down or 20 years down.
Yeah, futures started actually with the RAND Corporation in governments. They were the first folks to start thinking about this. And then most big companies at least have somebody they bring in from time to time to help them think about the future. What we're starting to see now is how do we spread that to, say, local governments and community groups so that everybody can be better able to understand what might be coming.
So, like city commissions, et cetera, that they might have a futurist who they would check in with from time to time?
I don't know many cities that have a futurist on staff. I've done some work with some of the local city commissions in this area, helping them just think as they start a new, particularly after a new group has been elected, think about what the main priorities are and what they want to think about. So they'll react to somebody. There are a few large nonprofits that actually have futurists on staff. The American Museum Association has an entire group of futurists that work with them.
That's ironic, isn't it? Obviously, a lot of museums have exhibitions dedicated to the past, right? So it's kind of interesting they might have a futurist on staff.
Yeah, for them, obviously, the future is one of those things that holds both opportunity and a lot of challenge because they're seeing how the traditional museum is no longer as popular as it used to be.
Right.
So they look at it for two things. One is, how do we think differently about how we present information about the past? And secondly, is there a different story we should be telling? In fact, there's a group meeting in, I believe, September in Toronto, where I'll be working with a group of folks to talk about how museums can tell stories about the future.
Mm-hmm. Have you done some work with museums?
I've worked with the Museum Association a couple of times. They actually did some interesting work a couple of years ago where they wanted to encourage people to create stories about the future of museums. And so I was one of the judges that helped them understand and help, you know, evaluate those stories and help teach people, how do you tell stories about the future?
Mm-hmm. Museums have gotten a lot more interactive, haven't they? I think they've borrowed quite a bit from what theme parks do, really immerse people in an experience. So I imagine there's something of that might come into what a futurist might be talking to a museum about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The theme parks became a huge unexpected form of competition for the museums, particularly places like Epcot that provided some sort of education and entertainment. So museums have fought back by becoming more immersive. You'll see a lot of use of virtual reality and augmented reality in museums today. That's their attempts to get ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe Tankersley, how did you become a futurist?
That's a long story. I'll try and make it relatively short. I've always been passionate about the future. My background is really a storyteller. And I started working at Disney in 1996 at Imagineering, working on projects at Epcot. And mm-hmm. So that, to me, was really exciting to think about the future. I went to my first World Future Society conference back then. I got Disney to send me to that. And I was really disappointed, because there were all of these guys with projectors and slides and, at that time, overhead transparencies, and they made the
future. Man, that's not very futuristic.
It's not, and they made the future seem really boring, and I knew that wasn't right. So for me, it was really interesting to think about how, as a storyteller, I could change that. Then sort of fast forward a couple of years, I was working on 100 Years of Magic, an exhibit many people around here know, reading about the history of Walt's life. And I came across a quote from Ray Bradbury where he referred to Walt as an optimistic futurist. And I realized that's what I want to be when I grow up. Mm-hmm. That idea of using positive stories to get people to think differently about the future.
Did it take you a while to figure out what your role in life was going to be, kind of find your niche?
That was my third or fourth different career at that point in time. Yeah, I've tried a bunch of different things as I've gone through it. And then once I discovered that, of course, it took me a few years at Disney to convince them that they needed an in-house futurist. I did a lot of explaining as to what futures were and finally sort of brought them back to their history, which was that's what a lot of what Walt did, both entertainment and otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So you were Disney's first in-house futurist?
I wasn't actually the first one. I was Walt Disney Imagineering's first in-house futurist. The Disney company, about the same time, had started some futures group in the human resources group. A young woman there who continues to work as a futurist here in Orlando started that group. And I did some work with them and worked with some of the other parts of the company. So I was involved in the future of workforce, the future of social capital, and, of course, the future of creativity.
Mm-hmm. I guess Epcot you know, it's a theme park, but it sort of started out with a slightly more lofty vision, right? Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow, I think, is the what it stands for. Is it your favorite theme park out of the Disney parks?
I have to say it probably is, just because of that history and what it was supposed to be. The challenge was that they built a bunch of huge buildings that had to last for 30 years, and the future caught up with them and got ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the lessons that I think we learned from that, is you can't create a static vision of the future. But I always have a soft spot, you know, for Epcot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the fact that those rides do seem a bit dated. I like the... That's what I like about them myself. So back in 1996, when you were getting into sort of figuring out what a futurist was and saying, I want to be one of those, what did the future look like? Because we're now, you know, 2019, some visions of the future are pretty bleak. 1996, what did it look like to you then?
Well, of course, 1996 was when the internet was going to change everything, and we were all going to live online, and it was going to be incredibly democratic.
We do kind of live online now.
Well, we do. You know, some of the promise I think we've lost in terms of the unexpected fact that there's still some very large corporate entities who control our lives online.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten darker since then. You know, the digital boom and bust sort of, I think, had an impact on that. Some other things have affected us. Right now, we're living in a very dark vision of the future. And that's one of the things that concerns me. I think mm-hmm. we need to change that attitude.
Right, and that's the subtitle of your book, Making Sure Your Future Doesn't Suck. So what are some of the things from the book? What is your prescription for making sure that 20 years from now we are not living in an even bleaker version of the future?
Well, the first thing is you have to understand that we have more agency to create the future than we give ourselves credit, particularly in the digital age that we live in. So we have to understand that we don't need to be waiting for someone else to create the future for us. The second thing is that we have to change the stories we tell ourselves about the future. We tend to think of the future as being more or less of today. What really is happening is we're moving through a phase where the digital world that we live in is going to create major disruptions, and we have the chance to completely reconceptualize. What does it mean to work? You know, what does it mean to have a democracy? What is a community's role? Those are some of the things, the conversations we need to have. So for me, the very first thing is start having the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Start thinking about different ways to think about the future, and then we can begin to create a future that's more equitable, that's more abundant, that is also more sustainable. I think those are the three things we need to focus on.
There are some things that are going to have to be taken care of, though, right? I mean, a lot of people are looking at things now and saying, we're worried about, for example, the climate. What's the world going to look like 50 years from now? You know, is it going to be a place that my grandchildren or great-grandchildren will want to grow up?
There is no question that we face real problems. And one of the challenges I have as an optimistic futurist is people believing that I think we're going to create a utopia. We're not. The future will always be messy. The past was always messy.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is that we have some new tools to address some of these problems. Climate change is a perfect example. In the last 10 years, the ability to use renewable energy sources has just skyrocketed. We're seeing exponential growth in that ability. We can solve some of that problem by moving to new energy sources. We can solve some of the problem by thinking about new ways to consume items, eliminating a lot of the waste that we create today, and we have that technology. But it's not all technology. It'd also be thinking differently about how do we consume, how do we live, how do we move around in the future. We're going to suffer consequences of climate change. We already are. But I think we can, if we're positive and look for opportunities, we can make those negative impacts less. That's my vision of the future.
Mm-hmm. Are you out on a limb a bit as a futurist? Are there still kind of different schools of thought for futurists? Are there some who are like, we can't sugarcoat this, we've got to tell everybody what the grim news is before we get to some of the good stuff?
There's certainly a strong trend toward dystopian futures, particularly in the popular media. That's where you see most of that. I'm not out on the limb. If you look at people like the folks at something called the Singularity University, Ray Kurzweil and that group in California, they are completely over the top in my mind and thinking about what the positive future is going to be, and it's all going to be rosy and great, and technology is going to make us free.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the guy who sits in the middle and sort of says, it's not as bad as you think it is. It could be better. There are going to be some problems. And in some ways, that's a difficult message for people because they like black or white. They like, mm-hmm. you know, it's going to be terrible, it's going to be great.
And is that, I mean, is it a challenge for you, especially if people say, look, you're a futurist, tell me what the world is going to be like in 20 years from now? Is that kind of challenging? How do you kind of get around that?
Well, the first thing, of course, is that I can't tell you exactly what the world's going to look like. I can't predict the future. No good futurist will do that. What I can do is help you think about what the different possibilities are. There are some things that are pretty obvious. This country's getting older. We're going to have to think about what that means. The impact of climate change is going to increase in the next few years. We're going to have to deal with some of these big problems. Those things are obvious. What I do is offer people alternatives that challenge their imagination, different ways to think about what would a future look like where we really reimagined aging, for instance. What would a future look like where we took this idea of the gig economy and turned it on its head and said, hey, let's make that work for people. Let's not make that something that just works for business. And by challenging them, what I want them to do is create their own visions of the future.
Do you think, Joe, in Florida, we're sort of ahead of the curve a little bit, because some of the things you talk about, you know, the challenges of climate change, the fact that we do have an aging population, Florida has been dealing with that for some time now anyway, because a lot of people, you know, retire to Florida. So we have maybe more folks who are, you know, the baby boomers and beyond moving to Florida. People have to figure out, like, the best way for folks that age and older to live their best life here in Florida and deal with some of the challenges they might have of getting around, even getting back into the workforce. I mean, you mentioned the gig economy too. Mm-hmm. So does Florida have an opportunity here that maybe other states in the United States don't have, because we do have some of these challenges up front?
Yeah, we're gonna get to that future about a decade before everyone else. And so we should be the leader in reimagining what aging looks like. We haven't done a great job so far, to be honest with you. There are some places like St. Petersburg, which are creating walkable downtown areas, which turn out to be incredibly important for an aging population and everyone else. So that's a great approach. We're still dealing with a lot of denial in terms of imagining that us boomers aren't going to get old. We just don't believe it yet. So that's my personal passion right now, obviously, because I am a boomer. I want to help people really start that conversation. I'd love to see Florida lead the way toward reimagining aging in the future. I think we've got the right resources to do it and the right problems.
Some of those things as well, you know, the gig economy, off the top of your head, or maybe not off the top of your head, since you're a futurist, you've been thinking about this. How do you turn that around? Because a lot of the stories you read, a lot of the headlines are about the fact that it's benefiting maybe some corporations and the folks who are actually working in the gig economy are finding that it's not as good as they thought it might be.
Right, absolutely. Right now, the gig economy is an excuse to cut off benefits to workers, to only have people on your payroll when you absolutely need them. If you project that out, though, and you think about what happens in 10 or 15 years, particularly with the technical tools that are available to people, what I suspect may happen is we'll see a turnaround. Suddenly, all of the gig workers are going to start to go, why do I need to even have a gig? Why am I not just doing this on my own? Let me explain that in more specifics. Take Uber, for example. The idea behind Uber is because of a piece of software, you know, you can get a ride whenever you want to, and I have a job whenever you need me. What we're already seeing is direct peer-to-peer car sharing. Who needs Uber? If you've got a car and I know how to contact you and I can work out an arrangement with you, and that means we don't have that middleman anymore. So that's really the future of this idea of the gig economy. It's really peer-to-peer economy. And that gives individuals more power. Now, the problem is individuals have to know how to collaborate. So we have to teach them how to be better entrepreneurs and how to work better together. But there are some huge opportunities there, I think, to make the gig economy the real future of work. The interesting thing in terms of the gig economy is the growth of co-working spaces. You know, WeWork is an excellent example of that. They've grown from being a very small startup to being a major corporation that's now talking about how they are part of your life, every part of your life, so that you have tribes like WeWork coming along in the future where you can actually be part of a WeWork corporation of sorts, do the work as an independent contractor, but use other facilities and other connections that they provide you, and suddenly, once again, you're much more powerful than you were as an individual. You know, that's their model for the future.
Is there anything that you look at and you say, even for myself as an optimistic futurist, this is pretty bad? I can't really put a positive spin on it.
It is tough, I think, to put a positive spin on the short term right now, because there's so much negativity going on and there are so many difficult problems that we have to change the way we talk about them. So I imagine that the next few years are going to be rocky. I see short term being tough. I am always optimistic about the longer term, but we're going to have to figure out different ways to think about some things, or we will not make these changes.
Well, Joe Tankersley is the author of Reimagining Our Tomorrows, Making Sure Your Future Doesn't Suck. Joe, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Matt. I really appreciate it.
That interview first aired on Intersection in April 2019. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Production assistance for today's show from our intern, Brittany Caldwell. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. You can also listen back to archived shows on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.